Okay, let's fire away. This is your time, so just ask me whatever questions you want, Mr. Whitfield.
I'm not exactly sure when things go to the jury.
Okay. Two different dividing points. One dividing point is issues of law and issues of fact. Issues of law are for the judge. Issues of fact are for the jury. There's a second dividing line. Issues of fact go to the jury where reasonable minds could differ. So again, in the turntable case, the court imagined a situation where a carriage goes off the cliff, and the plaintiff alleges the defendant was negligent. Even though that's a factual issue, the evidence may be so clear, one way or the other, that the judge says reasonable minds couldn't differ, therefore I'm going to decide this as a matter of law. So factual issues about which reasonable minds could differ go to the jury.
How about negligence per se? Does that always go?
There's a jurisdictional split on that one. So again, those jurisdictions that follow Cardozo, that say a statutory command is not one the jury has the freedom to set aside, those jurisdictions would say, once you've met the criteria for negligence per se, there has been a violation of statute, the statute was intended to address this kind of a case, and there is no excuse being presented, a Cardozo-type jurisdiction would say that gets taken away from the jury and gets decided as a matter of law. Some jurisdictions, like Washington, say even though it meets those criteria, the jury can still decide whether somebody going 62 miles an hour in a 60-mile-an-hour zone is really negligent. Okay, keep working on it there. Mr. Rusher? The judge decides that. Because remember that strict liability is an issue relating to an activity. It's not about this particular case. Whereas most negligence cases are not generic discussions about some activity. They're saying, was the defendant under these circumstances negligent? So that is a factual determination for the jury, whereas when I say that driving a tanker truck full of gasoline or driving a tanker truck full of jet fuel is an abnormally dangerous activity, I'm speaking not just to this case, I'm speaking to the activity of driving this kind of a vehicle, and therefore, if I'm going to be essentially making law, who is it that we want making law? It is judges. So the question about whether an activity is subject to strict liability is a question of law for the judge.
The responsibility
of the attorney, like it works. Yes. Yes, that remains. The fight that we had in Sigler versus Kuhlman, or at least the complaint that Justice Neal had in Sigler versus Kuhlman was not over a question of law, question of fact. It was the more basic principle, can you raise an issue on appeal that you failed to raise at the trial court level? And even if, as we were saying earlier, it is unjust in some sense that the plaintiff be saddled with the bad judgments of the plaintiff's lawyer, the way our system operates is, in effect, it is your responsibility to bring those issues at the trial court level that you plan to rely on, and it would obviously make a hash of things if we try one issue, lose on it, then we get to try another issue at some later date. You put it all out there. I have to say there are extraordinary circumstances in which courts will intervene where there's some, you know, particularly criminal case, you know, lack of adequate representation or some other extraordinary case. But the ordinary rule is that you have to bring it at the trial court level. It's frankly not explained by the majority in Sigler versus Coleman why they departed from that. Yeah.
Then with strict liability, is the jury's job to award damages?
Yes. If the judge... the jury may also have issues regarding proximate cause. That is, let us say, for example, we decide that operating a toxic waste dump is subject to strict liability. I live next door to the toxic waste dump. I get leukemia. I blame the defendant who operates the toxic waste dump. The judge determines, yes, the defendant is strictly liable for the toxic substances that got into the plaintiff's water, but the plaintiff still has to show my leukemia resulted from exposure to these chemicals, which might be a difficult assignment. Mr. Jones?
So in that last case with the tanker of gasoline, could the plaintiff's lawyers have had a pretrial motion that says, we want to try this on strict liability?
That's what they would have done. If I were the plaintiff in that case, I would have brought a motion for summary judgment to say, again, sort of a procedural issue, but summary judgment is a way of saying, before we get ready to try this case, I think there's a way to resolve it as a matter of law on some aspect of the case. For example, the defendant might bring a motion for summary judgment because the statute of limitations has run, or because the plaintiff had already settled with the defendant on some basis, or for some other reason why the defendant says, I shouldn't have to respond to this case. Similarly, the plaintiff, it's a little more difficult. Typically, the plaintiff has a whole bunch of things they have to establish before they're entitled to judgment, but the plaintiff could ask for summary judgment on the issue that this case is governed by a rule of strict liability. And then if they lose that, go ahead and try the negligence case, but at least you take a run at, in the same way that you might file a motion for summary judgment if you thought there was a statutory violation that would entitle you to negligence per se. I'll take a bite of the apple if I can to see if I can get a ruling as a matter of law in my favor. If I fail in that, I'll put my fate in the hands of the jury, but I'd much rather, at the outset, get a favorable ruling as a matter of law in my favor. Robert?
In the Sigler v. Coleman case, in the notes, they talk about non-reciprocal risk.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, I think it's a way of speaking of abnormally dangerous activities. One of the ways in which, for example, driving an automobile is not an abnormally dangerous activity is that we do it all the time. And even though we do impose that risk on other people, they impose it on us, and we're kind of all in the same ballpark. One of the reasons why, as a policy matter, you might want to impose strict liability is to say there really isn't that degree of sort of reciprocity of equality. There's one person who's imposing the risk, and there's somebody else who's suffering the risk, and therefore the people who are suffering the risk shouldn't be forced, in effect, to prove that the other person was negligent. Whereas when they're essentially on the same plane, treating them more or less equally makes more sense. Again, with respect to dogs, you could decide, hey, everybody benefits from having dogs, and let's have that subject to a rule of reasonable care. Or you could say the choice of owning a dog is one that should be done with the recognition, it's my job to keep this dog from harming other people, and if I can't stand the heat, maybe I should stay out of the kitchen. So the degree of reciprocity may matter but that's sort of a larger conceptual. It's not built into the standard. If I were advising a client, do I think this activity would be subject to strict liability? My guess would be that the standard is going to be based on the restatement criteria. Mr. Hines.
In understanding reasonable care, to get to that, that definition, how do we understand objective versus subjective?
Well, the Vaughn versus Menlove case was a way of sort of comparing a standard based upon reasonable care, trying as best I can, sort of good faith, good intentions. And what the court said is, no, that's a little bit too subjective for us. And as I described in the tape, there are, you could make some arguments as to why that would be a good standard, but for a variety of reasons, the courts say, no, we prefer a standard that is based upon a kind of objective determination. What did the 12 of us sitting on the jury think a reasonable person would do? And maybe that is something the defendant would find easy or difficult. Maybe it's unrealistic to expect that particular individual because of, you know, disabilities or some other circumstance. Very hard for them to do, but we think this is what a reasonable person should do. So in that sense, it's more objective than trying to peer into the person's soul or, you know, and find out whether they have exercised, sort of good judgment or they meant well, something along those lines. Ms. Townsend. Okay. It could be. In fact, I think this is one area where I haven't fixed the tutorial, the thing that's on your disk. I think I've got one of the questions that suggests that low social value is actually, or that high social value counts against the defendant. The criterion is in weighing whether something is abnormally dangerous, the court is invited, in effect, to say, well, we might have held this to be an abnormally dangerous activity, but we're worried that it has such high social value, we don't want to discourage it. So let's say you were talking about nuclear energy. Now, as it happens, I think Congress has dealt with nuclear energy and what the standards are for, you know, the liability of a China syndrome, you know, meltdown. But if the court were wrestling with that, they might at one point have said, gee, you know, we could subject this to strict liability, but it might result in discouraging this very important source of renewable energy or whatever and preventing air pollution, and therefore we choose as a matter of social policy not to impose this burden on the people who carry on this very valuable social activity. Again, the judge is making social policy in deciding whether to impose strict liability, because the people who ride down the highway in their semi-trucks full of bananas are only held to a standard of reasonable care. They have to buy insurance that covers them in the event they are negligent. So long as, you know, if there are accidents where they can survive the scrutiny and show that they used reasonable care, we don't impose a cost upon the people who carry around bananas for the accidents that are not their fault. The people who carry gasoline, on the other hand, we do impose the burden of paying for those accidents that are not their fault. And so before you do that, in effect, that last criterion says to the judge, think about whether this is an activity that you want to subject to strict liability, because after all, if it is of high social value and the effect of imposing this additional liability will be to make it less available to the community, that might say that it's no longer a good social policy to impose strict liability. Now, in the case of the gasoline, we've decided sort of in Bierman-like fashion that though it will raise the cost of gasoline by some increment, you know, maybe gasoline costs you a half a cent more or a quarter of a cent more or some fraction, a little bit more because of the additional insurance they have to purchase, because they're held strictly liable. And their insurance premiums would be lower, and therefore the cost of gasoline would be lower if they were only held to a standard of reasonable care. But that's overbalanced by these other factors, and we're quite confident that people are not going to stop buying gasoline, they won't stop making gasoline available by imposing strict liability. Instead, what will happen is that we are placing the cost of these accidents on the people who have some control over minimizing the risk, rather than imposing the costs on people like Carol House. Again, if the difference between Carol House or her estate recovering and not recovering is whether we impose strict liability, then it doesn't seem very fair to say to Carol House, well, because of the high social value of carrying gasoline, I'm sorry, this thing turned over and burned you to a crisp, but you don't get anything, and nor does your estate, because you couldn't prove negligence. She might understandably, or her estate might understandably say, well, wait a minute, the people who take this risk, who have control over who drives their trucks and how they're, you know, connected together and how fast they turn the corners, and I don't know, all the different variables that go into it, why shouldn't they bear the risk rather than me? So again, you're making social policy when you decide whether to impose strict liability or not. Mr. Herbert Holtz?
In a case like this, people are demanded to tax the file for
not of the accident, unless the facts of the accident are relevant to determining damages. They might be, for example, if there were a claim for, suppose Carol House died at the scene, but after suffering excruciating burns and lying in agony, you know, as they tried to frantically save her. Well, that might be an element of damage in the wrongful death case, in which case you would go through the facts of the accident. But if it's simply a basis, for example, of determining the value of her lost lifetime earnings, you know, other things that have nothing to do whether she was incinerated or, you know, whatever it is, if the assessment of damages doesn't require going through the facts of the accident, the judge will say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with it. Instead, the testimony would be, well, this was the career she was planning on, this is how much she would earn, and whatever other elements of damages there are. Some jurisdictions permit loss of relationship damages, you know, so that, for example, her spouse or her children would be able to claim the value of the companionship that they lost. Other jurisdictions say, no, this is only about, you know, economic loss. We're not going to get into emotional loss.
So it seems a little bit unfair that one jury can be allowed to find the facts.
There's actually, some of you may have seen the movie or read the book. It's one that gets assigned, I think Jerry Hess has assigned it in his course on civil procedure. It's called A Civil Action. And it's a true story. I think it got a National Book Award by a guy named, I don't think the author's name, Jonathan Haar, I think. He was a reporter for the Boston Globe or the New York Times or something. In any event, it's a story of a case of a toxic a chemical case in Massachusetts, Woburn, Massachusetts, outside of Boston, where a bunch of people got sick and many of them died from leukemia, and they blamed it on these tannery and some other source of chemicals that allegedly got into the wells used for the city water. And this guy named, what's that? Gotcha. Actually, his name, Jan Schlickman, was a lawyer. He's actually been active in this area. He tried a big case in Montana. I saw him on the news. I've seen him on some sort of panel discussions And from reading about him in the book, and then seeing him on TV, Travolta was not the guy I would have picked, because Schlickman is this elegant, classy guy, and Travolta is too much, you know, Saturday Night Fever, you know. He hadn't, you know, he'd taken off the polyester suit, but it's still sort of, anyway, not good casting. It's still a pretty good movie. The only quibble I had with the movie is that you can't do in 2 hours justice to the book. And my mother actually sent me the book about 10 years ago, and I, you know, looked at the back. She'd gone and so forth. I looked at the back and said, you know, this is a book that's so gripping you can't put it down. And I thought, oh, yeah, book about law I can't put down. That'll be the day. yeah, so I, but to make her happy, I started reading it, and I. It was 4 o'clock the next morning, and I finally, I was 200 pages short or whatever it was, but it actually, it's a very, to me, it was a very gripping story, and it helps you understand the way these cases proceed, and it's, let me just tell you, if you've seen the movies, knows, it doesn't have a happy ending, at least, you know, not for Schlickman. Schlickman did come back. Reappear, but in any event, it's a good book just to sort of see how cases go and get the procedural stuff. There is a there is an event. The reason this digression is vaguely relevant is because there is an event in the middle of the preparation for the case where the defendant asks for a bifurcation, that the jury will first rule on the factual issues and then we'll get to damages. In fact, there's a moment at the very beginning where the defense lawyer says, I will never let you put the plaintiffs on the witness stand. Or he says that to his client, I forget what he says. If they put the parents of these dead children on the witness stand, I'm done. But he maneuvers successfully. He's the Robert Duvall character in the movie. That's a good casting, by the way, of the defense lawyer. But he persuades this federal judge to split it up. Ordinarily, that's not done. Ordinarily, the jury takes the whole package, damages, liability, all of these issues, and they're given the whole package. But part of the reason the case does not have a happy ending is they're initially assigned only the liability questions, which are dry as dust and involve these complex geological assessments. Anyway, meanwhile, back to the ranch. Yeah?
One question about the test. Are your sample answers, do you consider a perfect score? And if so, one thing I'm a little bit confused.
Perfect's kind of a high standard.
One thing I'm confused about, there was some kind of...
I think I can answer your question, though. It's an A answer.
The second part of that is, you talk about maybe, you know, negligence, sometimes you go in and respond to
yes.
You're going to do it, other times if you're going to skip the applying
right. I give you the sample answer in part to encourage you, to have you look at the sample answer and have you say, I could do that. Whereas if I watch, you know, the NBA finals, and no matter how hard I try, I can never do that, you know? So when you look at the sample answer, it should be something where you say, ooh, you know, this is, I don't have the same reactions when I'm watching the NBA finals. Good, I'm glad for that. Is it the very best answer that could ever be struck? Is it a perfect answer? No way. But it's a reasonable, it's something that, now, it, I would also say it is rare for me to find such an answer. And I actually got an email from somebody a couple of semesters ago saying, you know, there's a rumor that these are C answers and not A answers. So I wrote back to the class saying, I have to confess I'm a little miffed here, you know, that you would ever confuse what I consider some of the finest pieces of English prose, with a C answer, but I said, you know, maybe, again, the confusion arises from the fact that it's not everything that could possibly said about it, but you don't have time to say everything. You only have an hour on Monday. So what you have to do is realistically assess, what can I do in an hour, and how can I do the most good for my client? Again, the standard is, in an hour, what is the greatest benefit I can provide to my client to help them get a window on this case, to see what's coming up, to see what are the most important issues, to get a sense, should I get my checkbook out and get ready to write a big check? Should I be counting on this to pay for my college, my kids' college education? Should I basically look at this as a lost cause? You know, where do I stand on this? Should I tell the plaintiffs, go soak your heads, I won't pay you a penny? If your answer is helping your client get as close as you can in an hour to knowing the answer to that question, that's a good answer. So your choice of what to talk about in what depth should be driven by, well, what's going to give my client the most help? I must say that from a student's perspective, you sort of have it the other way around. It is, what are the things I know about, and how can I get them in this answer? It's my, you know, when what you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So part of your adjustment is to turn it the other way around and say, what of what I know will benefit my client? Now, to be sure, running through the list in your head, I know this, I know this, I know this, what of these things applies? That's a useful way of solving the problem. If you drive up to the to your customer's door, they've got, you know, plumbing problems, you look around in your truck and say, oh, what of the tools that I have here could be applied to my problem? But again, you don't want to move too quickly. You want to first identify the client's problem, then go to your tool collection, rather than simply doing it the other way around. So, long answer to your question, but I hope that Mr. Wally.
In United States for Brent.
Yes.
What if the instrument that caused harm was not the instrument that? What if the instrument that attracted the kids to the place was not the instrument that caused the harm to the children?
Well, for homes, that's the big deal. Now, I don't think that's a very reliable summary of the modern law on that point. Mm-hmm. But again, one of the things that we're doing in that sort of exercise in the very beginning is learning how to read cases and to see how cases can help you, but may also mislead you when you go to advise a client. So, to the extent that Holmes's theory, and Holmes's theory does survive in many jurisdictions, not a majority, but a significant number, use this so-called allurement doctrine. Now, again, none of this is going to be tested on until we get to the next semester. But again, that's the difference between looking at a case and saying, oh yeah, for purposes of this case, that's a relevant criterion, but does that solve my client's problem? Not necessarily.
So the stuff in the intro is not on
the... Stuff in the intro, no, it's just kind of grist for your mill, sort of tuning up, calibrating your instruments here, and then starting with chapter one are the principles that, at least with respect to tort law, that we're working on for purposes of this exam. With you.
I've got questions about the whole safety policy question.
Okay.
The whole Walmart case.
Yeah. Okay.
What I don't understand is, like, I understand there's a very fine line here. Okay, when you can use the thing as evidence and you can't use the thing as evidence.
Actually, I think the thing you want to take away from the Walmart case initially is a pretty clear statement, which is, what do we do with post-accident repairs? What's the rule on that?
Post-accident repairs can't
Yes, they are inadmissible. So that's the starting proposition. Now, there are exceptions to that rule, and those exceptions are... Okay.
Like the exceptions, like the proof of ownership, proof of feasibility...
And again, all of these are triggered. The exceptions come into play when the defendant makes a fuss about something. The defendant says, excuse me, but that wasn't my property. Or excuse me, but that wasn't my car that was used in the fatal accident or whatever. Or it wasn't feasible for me to put a bulletproof glass. Or... the last one is that the defendant, through some other means, the first two, by contesting ownership or contesting feasibility, makes a post-accident repair relevant. In the third category of exceptions, the defendant otherwise introduces the, opens the door, raises the very post-accident repair that the plaintiff then follows up on. So only when the defendant essentially puts the post-accident repair in play by contesting ownership, contesting feasibility, or by bringing it up themselves, the stupid manager starts talking about putting the mats out after she fell, then suddenly they become admissible. But if the defendant's cagey about it and they don't go there, the plaintiff is stuck with the rule of saying, sorry, that evidence is inadmissible. Nelson?
But the feasibility is only an issue if they've been asked or someone has said put it in before and they said it wasn't feasible prior to the accident?
The defendant makes feasibility an issue if the defendant says it would not have been reasonable for me to do that because it was not feasible for me to do it. So, for example, you wanted me to put mats out. Well, all the mats have asbestos in them, you know, or, you know, there's some other reason. I couldn't do the thing. It was not feasible for me to do the thing you wanted me to do.
So the plaintiff in the bulletproof glass might say you were not being reasonable because you didn't have the bulletproof glass. He says, well, it's not feasible. And he said, well, you put it in right
exactly.
After.
Okay. Or, exactly. And or go back to Adams versus Bullock. Suppose the plaintiff had evidence that on certain bridges they put these little sort of hats over protective guards over the overhead wires. And the defense, oh no, we couldn't do that. It's not feasible because you got to go, oh, but you did it over here. Again, if the defendant's argument against the allegation of negligence is that the proposed safety measure wasn't